to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. And tell you what, when was the last time you jump-started your car? I've got a little story I could tell. Jim Ward in the studio with me today is the service manager at Smart Motors Toyota in Madison. Lots of experience, 10 years of master certification. And he is with us today to answer your vehicle questions. We'll talk about jump-starting your battery and give you some tips on winter driving as well. And, of course, he'll take any of your vehicle questions. So I hope you'll join in today. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Jim Ward, welcome back.
Thanks, Larry. It's great to be here on this sunny, warm, late November day.
You know, the last time I had a battery issue, I managed to click off the automatic shutoff of my lights. And I got in the garage, shut the car off, didn't bother, went in the house, came out the next morning, and the battery's dead, of course.
Yeah.
Fortunately, my neighbor has a unit that you made for this. You plug it into the wall socket. I didn't have to move, try and push the car out of the garage or anything. He hooked it up. He knows how to do that. He hooked it up properly, started the car, and I was fine, and I haven't had any trouble since.
And those are a great little tool to have. They've gotten a lot more reasonable in price, and the little booster pack or jumper pack, they even make them now. Of course, lithium batteries are the popular battery type. You can have a much smaller battery. So there are little packs that are not much bigger than like a checkbook wallet combination that has this battery pack in it. You can charge your cell phone or you can jumpstart your car. Now, there's quite a bit of performance difference in some of those units. But the best of them, even at cold temperatures, can jumpstart a car. And of course, the advantage is you don't have to have that neighbor or somebody else there. If you have that yourself, you don't have to have a donor vehicle to help jumpstart you. You don't have to worry that if your vehicle's in the garage the wrong way, the jumper cables may not be long enough to get to it. And jumper cables are great and they still work, but those definitely make you more independent if you have that problem.
Absolutely. Well, I guess if you turn the key and the car doesn't start, you assume automatically the battery's dead. Is that?
That's usually the case, although, you know, something, there are so many little quirks that can happen in cars that are in the normal realm. And one of the things that's a little trickier to interpret on newer cars is a lot of cars have a push button start now. You don't have a key that you put in ignition and turn.
Right.
Back when we did have that, occasionally you'd have this situation where you'd turn the key, but it wouldn't turn far enough to start the car. And you had to play this two-handed game with the steering wheel lock and the key to get the key to turn. Well, the push button start cars have the same potential to have interference between the steering lock and the start button, except that you aren't going to have that tactile feel. You don't know that it didn't allow it to go that far. Most cars will have a little warning light on the dash that would show that a little green light that's supposed to give you the hint that this is going on. But many people, you know, of course, the first thought is that the battery must be dead. The engine didn't crank over. It didn't do a thing. When in fact, in a lot of cases, if you turn that steering wheel just a little bit one way or another, tried pushing the button again, it would go. But the key is the steering wheel locked or not? If the steering wheel is locked when you're trying to do that and you've pushed the button, then that's the problem. If the steering wheel turns, then it may be the battery. But there are so many little differences in some of the modern in-cabin technologies that make it a little trickier to really, for a driver, just sitting there to understand what's happening, whether it is the battery or something else. Although, usually with a battery, you get that slow cranking, you know, clickety-click-click sounds that give you a clue that that's probably what's going on.
You know, I was trying to remember what I paid for my jumper cables, which I have way in the car. But there is quite a difference. I looked online. There's a lot of difference in price.
There is, and there's quite a difference in what they'll do as performance. I mean, you could think of it like extension cords. You can buy a really inexpensive extension cord, but if you're plugging something like a big heater or something that takes a lot of power, you probably want a heavier-duty extension cord. And with jumper cables, the gauge of the wire, the smaller gauge, the larger the wire, you want a fairly large gauge wire. And if you're going to use jumper cables, there isn't a There's definitely price differences, but you can get a decent set of jumper cables that are 20 feet long, that are a gauge of wire that's a large gauge, can handle a lot, that have good,
what
decent
would be a
clamps.
Large gauge?
Six or eight.
Six or eight.
So those, you know, there is a difference in quality. Not to say that most of the time, a cheap little set of jumper cables, you know, most of the time the battery's barely discharged to the point, you know, if somebody left the lights on, it's probably not stone cold dead like a car that sat for 6 months. Any jumper cables are probably enough. But if it's a critical situation and very, very cold or the car sat long, the better the jumper cables, the better results you're going to get.
What about... With hybrid vehicles on the road these days,
for the most part, you can jump a hybrid vehicle, and you can jump start from a hybrid vehicle. One of the things about the 12-volt battery, though, in a hybrid, is that they're typically a much smaller battery. They don't really start the car. They run and power the computers that tell the big battery to start the car. And it doesn't, most of them, they're not all the same. Not all hybrids are the same, but typically... many hybrids have a different type of battery that's not in under the hood. It's actually often inside the car. It's a AGM, alloy glass mat battery that doesn't outgas, so it can be in the passenger compartment. So in those cases, Toyotas are that way. Honda and Ford typically have a more of a conventional battery setup, but some hybrids then will have a special jump start terminal under the hood. So you'll have like a fuse panel that's got a cover that comes off, a big red cover over this jump start terminal, and you hook your jumper cables up to that, and you can jump start the hybrid from that, or you can jump start another car from the hybrid. It's a little trickier jump starting another car from a hybrid in as much as that, again, the hybrid battery is not very big, so it doesn't have a lot of power to give that other car. And if that's what you're trying to do, your best bet's probably to leave the batteries connected to each other for like 5 minutes before you even try to start the other car, just to let it let the dead battery absorb
that
voltage and amperage slowly over the few minutes of time. But hybrids. Interestingly enough, one of the things we occasionally see when people make a mistake in jump starting a car, or when it's just it can be just too much amperage. There can be surges that occur under the best of circumstances. And of all of the different instructions I've read for jump-starting cars, the Ford Fusion Hybrid has got an instruction to put the blower motors in both cars on. Usually, most instructions will tell you to turn all the accessories off, but the blower motor uses a straight-up 12 volts that's not modified from the battery. And ultimately, their theory is that can absorb those surges and potentially prevent damage to other components. And interestingly enough, when people, on certain Toyota models, when people make a mistake jump-starting and accidentally touch the wire to the wrong place, so I can't tell you how many times I've heard somebody, but I just touched it for a second. Well, electricity is that fast. And often it'll burn out the blower motor circuit. It'll take out that blower motor. So I had never read that anywhere before the Ford manual, but based on experiences I've seen with blower motors and jump starting and the errors that can happen, that is also a good idea. I've never seen recommended anywhere else before the Ford Fusion Hybrid manual. So it's an interesting point. It's not a bad idea on any car, but the most important thing is if you're jump starting a car, just be very careful. More and more, you try to Google something like that, and half the sources will say, just don't do it. Just call AAA. Just call the motor club. And I've read that AAA in many areas won't jump start hybrids because of the potential for damage that can occur. But really, if you follow the instructions, you put the red cable on the vehicle with the dead battery first on the positive. The battery should have a positive sign, a little positive embossed sign right on it. You might have to wipe the top of the battery off to see it if it's dirty, but or if it's a hybrid, you may have to use that jump start terminal, but you put your positive cable on there, then you put the positive cable on the positive terminal of the donor vehicle, and then you put your negative cable onto a metal surface on the dead battery vehicle that's something not painted, like a bolt on the engine block or the frame. And then finally, you put your negative cable on the donor vehicle that's jump starting. And ultimately, different guides, some will tell you that the donor vehicle should be running. Typically, most guides will say that. It doesn't necessarily have to be. If your lights have just been on a couple hours in a parking lot, it probably doesn't need that much power. And if the engine's not running, you have that much less potential, that much less power going through there. So the shorter the time the battery's been dead, the less impact and voltage amperage you need to really get it jump started. So, but if it's stubborn and it's been a long time, then the donor vehicle should be running. You're probably best off to let it run for about 5 minutes, let that dead battery absorb some power, and then you start your
vehicle. Start her up.
And then at that point, you want to disconnect those cables in exactly the reverse order. You're going to take the negative cable off the donor vehicle. You're going to take the negative cable off the metal surface or bolt you put it on the vehicle that had the dead battery. You're going to take the positive terminal off the donor vehicle, and then the positive cable end off of the vehicle that had the dead battery, and then always being very careful of where those cable ends are going, what they touch as you swing across. And but you know, it's a basic kind of thing, but electricity is as fast as light, and it's unforgiving. So if you make
there
a mistake,
you go.
Something's going to happen.
Jim Ord, our guest, great to have him along. And Luann in Green Bay has a question for you, Jim. So let's go there. Hi, Luann.
Hi, my husband has a 2002 Suburban, which he loves because you can put a whole sheet of plywood in the back.
Yes, yeah.
But we had trouble. It's got about 250,000 miles. We had trouble this summer when we were on vacation. We were pulling a boat. It's his boat. It's a wood boat. It's light. But the engine just stopped. It just cut out while we were going. My husband thought it was cruise control, so we tried it without cruise control, and things went well for a while, and then the same thing happened. And then it didn't happen again until we were driving through Minneapolis and with the boat. But we came back and we took it to we ended up taking it to the dealer, the GMC dealer, and they couldn't get it to happen, and quite frankly, we haven't been able to get it to happen again either. Do you have any idea?
Well, let me just make sure that I understand exactly what happened. When you say it shut off, it was as though you turned the key back and it was off. You had to actually restart it.
And I was driving once, and believe me, when the power steering cuts out, turning that
big
car
vehicle
to the side of the road is terrible.
Yeah.
So when you went to restart it, did it just start right back up like there was no issue?
A couple of times it started right back up, and then a couple of times it took maybe a couple tries.
And when it took a couple of tries, what happened there? In other words, I would imagine either you turn the key and it's going rum, 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 and it's not really firing, or it's kind of starting and stumbling and running kind of rough before it really gets going.
It sounded like it was running rough.
Okay.
We haven't been able to replicate it, and it was warm when it happened once, and it was cold when it happened again, and we were going up a hill once and coming on level and going down. You know, we're just...
Yeah. You know, the best technician, the best shop is not going to be able to find that problem as intermittent as it is unless they get lucky and catch it red-handed, which, of course, is a difficult part. You know, it's so if I understand, it's only happened when you had the boat connected, and
no. I forgot that part. Yeah, then it did once when we didn't.
You know, there's a lot of possibilities. This isn't like a common Suburban thing. Suburbans are a pretty bulletproof vehicle, but I suspect we probably have some kind of electrical ground problem somewhere. It's just a shop, unfortunately, is going to have to get fortunate enough to catch us in the act. If it's acting up, you know, if you can catch it acting up, especially with the difficulty to start afterwards, you can pretty quickly narrow down where you're lacking power, whether you've got a spark or fuel or just an electrical ground issue that is causing the problem. But it's unfortunately everything is still a possibility until they can make a little more headway. I mean, a 2002 Suburban with 250,000 miles on it is just a classic. I've recently read on Hagerty that those are one of the most popular vehicles to buy and restore to be able to get for under $10,000. I mean, they're great vehicles, a great utility, but yep, that particular problem is going to take some sniffing and probably having, you know, a mechanic. I mean, it sounds like somebody could drive it for a week and probably still not experience it, as random as it's been.
It's happened maybe 10 times since July.
Yeah. Oh boy, those are just the toughest ones that just drive us crazy. You could have somebody go through and check the main ground connections for the electrical system under the hood and for the battery and alternator and everything, and that's probably a good idea just to make sure, but certainly no guarantee that that's where the problem lies. It's just too wide open.
But you're worth a try. Give that a shot, Luann, and let us know next time Jim's on if that was the problem. Thank you very much. Oh, boy. Joe in Menominee. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Hi, Joe.
I recently purchased a 2014 Avalon Hybrid, and it makes three funky noises that I'd like to talk to you about. One of them is, it's our first hybrid, so we're not familiar with the vehicles. When you start the vehicle and drive it, when you stop at a stop sign and then take off, it shudders. And I'm assuming that's from the gasoline engine starting up.
Well, probably. I mean, I'm assuming you don't have any warning lights on, and it's not a shutter, not a severe shutter, I suspect. But, I mean, the vehicle can take off from a stop without the gasoline engine starting at all. You could potentially, if you're light enough on the throttle and if you don't have air conditioning or heat on, you could potentially take off from a stop with the gas engine completely silent. One of the things about the transmission, transaxles, and the CVTs and most of these vehicles is that they're designed to be in a very high gear ratio setting at a very low speed to try to get the best gas mileage. Under the right circumstances, you could be in, you know, what would be the equivalent of fifth gear in a manual transmission vehicle at 28 miles an hour. And there are times when, you know, your throttle input and the vehicle's computer's interpretation of what you want to do, there might be some lag or confusion there. It's like the transmission might, a lot of people describe it as indecisive. And that's not really abnormal. I mean, it's the price that we pay for having something that mm-hmm. can get that kind of gas mileage and that kind of performance. So I'm not so sure that what your experience is necessarily anything wrong with it. It sounds like a fairly typical description that people make of what we call transmission computer indecisiveness, but it's not necessarily an error. And it is an adaptive vehicle. It does learn your driving style over time. It basically, in about 30 drive cycles, a person who every time they step on that gas is like, well, that's not enough, and they step it down harder quickly, in that time their gas pedal is going to have more throttle open in a quarter inch of gas pedal throw than a person who every time they step on it's like, whoa, I didn't expect that, and backs off right away. It's going to learn that person wants less, and they're going to have a half inch of throttle or gas pedal throw before they get the same throttle opening. So, you know, if you bought it used recently, depending on how long you've had it, it may still be learning your driving styles, but that sounds fairly normal, actually.
Okay.
It's got a weird rattle when it's cold. When you start out with a vehicle, there's a rattle in the back, and after the vehicle warms up for, let's say, 5 minutes, when you go over bumps, it won't rattle anymore, which is really kind of strange.
Well, you know, ultimately that one is going to bear some, if it's consistent, you know, basically somebody's going to need to take it out for a ride. Those are one of those things where, you know, we do a physical inspection of the vehicle underneath to look and see if the exhaust maybe has been bumped, because the exhaust does heat up. It expands. So that logically is something that would change as the car heats up, as opposed to suspension parts that typically are going to function about the same, warm and cold. But, you know, initially we do a visual inspection for that kind of thing to look and see if the exhaust has been tweaked or one of the mounts is off a little bit. You know, if you back a tailpipe, if it's accidentally ever been backed into a post or a snowbank or anything, it can shift those exhaust hangers a little bit, and that could give you some of that kind of thing. If everything on a visual inspection looks good, it comes down to playing with a love-hate relationship tool that is called the chassis ears, that you have little clips that you can put on different components, and you have a little earphone you put in your ear inside the car, and channels that you can switch from clip to clip, and you switch back and forth to different components while you're driving it and hearing the noise in the car and isolate through that method where the noise is coming from.
Interesting.
Gotcha. Now the brakes, one last thing, when you apply the brakes, it makes a noise. And it's consistent whether your vehicle is sitting stationary and not even running.
Sure.
You apply the brake.
Yep. The hybrid's got a really different braking system. Most of the braking that you do is actually done by the hybrid regenerative braking. So it's not the brake at the wheel that's slowing the car down. It's turning those electric motors that make the car go when you accelerate, turning them into generators that generate power and cause braking action. But right as you come to a stop, or right before you come to a stop, or depending on how hard you brake and the circumstances, the system switches from that hybrid regenerative braking to the conventional braking. And there are devices that have to have brake fluid under pressure, loaded, these little actuators that have to have that system ready to mm-hmm. whatever pressure and whatever you're going to do next. And so what you're going to hear, and what I think suspect you're hearing, is the filling of these actuators and that activity going on of those things readying themselves for that conventional brake application. And that's also a very normal noise. There are some noises you're going to hear in hybrids that you don't hear in conventional cars. The owner's manuals actually have a little section on some of the normal noises you'll hear in that vehicle. But yep, you know, that I don't know about the rear noise that rattle you're talking in the back. That sounds like something that could be addressed and probably a minor adjustment. But, yep, that braking noise is pretty normal.
Thanks a lot, Joe, for calling. Appreciate your call. Jim Ward, our guest today, service manager at Smart Toyota Motors. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer. Here on the Ideas Network, Louisa DeVogel is answering the phones today. Thank you for listening, and stay with us. We got more with Jim Ward coming right up. Coming up this afternoon on Central Time, the conflict over player protests during the national anthem continues within the NFL, and Rob Ferret, our host, will talk with his guest about a proposal to eliminate the conflict by having the players stay in the locker room for the anthem. That's today on Central Time. Right now, taking a look at vehicle maintenance with Jim Ward, service manager at Smart Motors of Madison. And, you know, before we go back to the phones, and Daryl and Platteville's up next, you see so many ads these days for the new cars where the braking system happens automatically. A deer runs out or a little child runs out and the car stops immediately. How do they work?
Well, they use radar and sonar systems. They use what was called millimeter wave radar that basically is watching out in front of the car and watching for any obstacles or obstructions that it may be able to sense. This technology started out a few years ago when cars had what was called radar cruise control, where you could set your cruise control to a certain speed, and but it would also adjust for traffic. So in other words, if you had nothing in the lane in front of you, it would go to your set speed. But if a car pulled out in front of you, it's going to back off, and usually had adjustments. But it used that technology essentially to just help the cruise controls keep your spacing and your distance and match mm-hmm. the speed of the vehicle ahead of you until it pulled back in, and kind of did that automatically so you didn't have to really, yeah. you know, brake and then reset your cruise or resume your cruise or anything. So that technology was kind of the start of it. But then, of course, they've tied those into braking systems, and the systems have gotten far more sophisticated. Usually, there's a suite of technologies on a car that use a set of sensors to do a number of things that just seem magical if you think about how cars worked a few years ago. But essentially, they're it's as though you've got you essentially do have a radar and sonar systems that are sensing anything in front of the car. They have sensors that are for rear cross traffic, like backing out of driveways. You've got proximity sensors on the side of the car, blind spot monitors essentially that will tell you and light up if there's something in your blind spot that you may not see in your mirrors. There are what are called lane departure cameras, a camera that goes up by your rearview mirror looking forward that can actually read what would be the lanes of the road. And if you're like falling asleep and your car's starting to drift out of its lane, it can actually alert you and tell you, because if you didn't put a turn signal on, you're leaving your lane, it's expected that's an abnormal function. Mm-hmm. It'll try to warn you, and it'll even make it so that it's easier to turn the steering wheel in the corrective direction, harder to turn it in the wrong direction, going further into that lane. These are the technologies that are, you know, eventually going to make an autonomous self-driving car. The technology is not there yet. They're not perfect. They are able to make errors. Some of the systems have had recalls where if you drove over a metal plate, it might sense that as an obstruction, and they had to do some adjustments on how those sensors would read. But yeah, it's essentially using radar, sonar, millimeter wavelength radar technologies and cameras to,
amazing.
You know, the little angel over your shoulder is getting more powerful than ever.
Daryl and Platteville, thanks for waiting. Hello.
Well, good morning. How are you today?
Great. Appreciate
How's it going,
the call.
Darryl?
Good, good. See, my 03 Buick doesn't have any of those cameras.
Okay. There's one. Yep, you control everything.
My question is, I have 183,000 on an 03 Buick Century, and my mechanic was talking about having a transmission flush. And I've talked to four people, and half of them say definitely don't do it, and half of them say you should do it. So I figured I'd ask the expert.
Well, you know, it is you're probably not having any problems with it. I would imagine no symptoms, and you know, it usually, you know, just is something that I would typically say leave well enough alone. Now, transmission flushes are something that used to be real commonplace in an 03 probably still has a Dextron transmission fluid system. A lot of newer cars have a world spec that is a synthetic fluid that really doesn't have a service interval unless you tow. And ultimately, you know, really the use of the transmission and how it's used and what its life has been like really determines how much that fluid's going to break down. You know, if you've towed with it, if you've gotten stuck in a ditch and had to rock it back and forth, reverse to drive, those things are hard on transmission fluid, cause some breakdown. They're a little hard on the clutch packs that are in a transmission, can cause some fiber to get in there. But generally, the sniff test and the visual test of pulling the dipstick out and taking a look at it, does it smell kind of burnt? Transmission fluid that's getting bad, that's like if a car has gotten stuck and you've gone back and forth in reverse and drive, off, and that fluid will have kind of a burnt clay smell to it. And if you've got residual, you know, if you wipe the fluid off the stick and there's some residual tarry stuff staying on there, it's an indication that it's getting thick. You know, there are people who will swear that if you do a transmission flush on a car like that, you may create problems where there weren't any before. You know, generally that's not the case. But then there's the question of, is it worth the investment? Do you really need to do it? If you're not having any problems and that fluid still looks and smells decent, I would say it's not necessary.
There you go. Thanks a lot for calling. Joe in Eau Claire, it's your turn. Hi, Joe.
Yeah, hey, thanks for taking my call. Great show. I've got a 2004 Saab, original owner, 180,000 miles. A while ago, I was getting some clunking noise backing up, and the springs were winding up, and was told the strut mounts need to be replaced. I had that done, does not do that. But over a rough road, I do still hear some clunking, and the next advice was the link pins were loose and need to be replaced. So what are the link pins, and what else would I be looking for some type of clunking over a rough road, over a manhole cover, something like that? Other than that, no problems with the car.
Yep. Different vehicles use different types of suspension arms and bars to control how the suspension's set up and how it's going to react over bumps. And on the Saab, you've got links between your control arms and what are called trailing lateral arms. And what is a sway bar? And the link is kind of like, it's like an elbow joint or like a wrist joint. You got a ball and socket knuckle there and a link that holds it together. And those do wear out over time. So, I mean, ultimately, I don't know that those, you know, it's probably not an emergency repair. They're not known for coming apart while driving down the road and causing loss of control or breakdown. But they'll wear over time. Noises can be disconcerting, you know, and it is a good idea to get them taken care of just so you're not, then you know that that's exactly what it was and it wasn't something more serious or something other than that and don't have to worry about it. You have more peace of mind driving it.
All right, there we go. Thank you for calling. Bob and Franklin, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hello.
Hi, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I have a 2016 Subaru Outback. I've had to jump start this vehicle about 5 times. There was one time where everything was turned off, but I opened up the back power door.
Yeah,
and left it open for a while. When I got back in, or I got back to it, the door wouldn't close, and then it wouldn't start.
Sure.
The dealer told me, "Well, we checked it out. There's nothing wrong."
Well, and there probably wasn't when they were looking at it. There's a number of newer vehicles I've seen that when that back door is open, will leave a dome light on. And I've seen a couple models where there wasn't even a switch to separately shut that dome light off. I've had people that have, you know, the be vendors at the farmer's market that take things right out of the back of the vehicle and want to leave it open for a whole few hours that they're there, and ultimately have to either pull that bulb out or do something to. And you know, one of the complications too is that when you leave a door open on a modern vehicle like a 2016 Subaru, that vehicle's got a number of computers. There's a body electric computer that normally when you shut the car off, those computers go to sleep essentially, but often if you leave a door open, that one doesn't go to sleep. So it's possible that something's created a battery draw condition from that door being open. But so you said it's had to be jump started 5 times. What period of time was that over? Is this over months and months or
over months? Yeah, it's one time I was at the airport waiting for somebody. I had the radio playing for about 10 minutes, and when I tried to start it up, it wouldn't start.
Ugh, and you'd think after only 10 minutes, you'd think it should, but then it depends on how you have the key set, too. You should be able to play your radio without seeing all of the red lights, the warning lights on the dash that you'd have. So in other words, there's an accessory position before the on position, before the start position. That accessory position is where you want to listen to the radio. If you go to the on position where all those red lights are on, you've turned quite a few computers on, and it's a pretty incredible draw of power. How many miles are on that car now?
About 17,000.
And you've had it a little over a year?
A year and a half.
So that's not really low mileage. Sometimes really low mileage cars will see batteries discharge. It's possible that something's intermittently drawing on the battery, that you can have a circuit malfunction that causes a draw in when there shouldn't be one. And if you're not testing the vehicle when the draw is there, of course you're going to show normal draw on that battery. There's nothing wrong. So that may be the kind of thing. Sometimes it takes some experimentation to get to the bottom of that, of pulling fuses individually. But of course, if it did it every night, it would be easy. If you pulled a fuse and it didn't do it one night, that circuit's it, and you kind of narrow it down. But, the best bet may be for a shop to have it 2 or 3 days at some point and test it each day. Because, again, one test telling you there's no draw doesn't necessarily give you the right picture over time. There, you can have an intermittent electrical draw, but again, with all the computers on a modern vehicle, leaving a door open, depending on how you turn the ignition on to have an accessory like the radio on, can definitely create situations where the battery discharges a lot faster than you might think, or that we might have been used to once upon a time on a more conventional car that didn't have all the computers.
Yeah, interesting. Thanks, Bob, for calling. You can join in, too, by the way. We have some open lines. Get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call with your vehicle maintenance question. Bob in Sheboygan has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Bob. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Okay, I have a question. I've got a 2015 Chevy Traverse that we bought new. Okay, and I guess it was maybe about 10 months old. And my wife was taking it to Texas to visit her sister. And twice on the way down, the engine just about stalled out completely while she was on the freeway. She got down there okay. And my brother-in-law is a retired mechanical engineer. And he said, are you using ethanol gas? And she said, yes. And she said, okay. He said, change it. Don't use it anymore. Okay. And on the way back, there was no problem. Okay, she came back, and I told her, well, hell, we used ethanol gas before. Let's try it again. Okay, and we took it up. I've got a cabin northwest of Krivitz, and I put ethanol gas in it, and on the way home, the same thing happened. Okay, I got just about to Sheboygan, and it got darn near stalled out on the freeway again, and I took it to the Chevy dealership, and they couldn't find anything wrong. Now, would that non-ethanol, or would the ethanol gas cause that problem?
Well, it shouldn't, particularly if you're using 10%. But ethanol fuel is available in what's called a flex fuel, E85. And if you were to put E85, if you put a full tank of E85 in a car that's not a flex fuel vehicle, will probably run, but it's going to run real rough. It's probably going to turn the warning lights on. And although really it's just a matter of getting that fuel out or getting the level down enough to put in either 10% or non-ethanol fuel to dilute it down, shouldn't really hurt any other components on it. So if it was E85 fuel that was put in it, that would definitely cause a problem.
This was the 10%.
This was 10%. Now, I have seen a few makes of vehicles. I don't know that I've seen that on that Traverse, but there's a few makes of vehicles. The way that the fuel systems deal with that ethanol is they have alcohol density. They have a system to be able to sense the alcohol density and be able to set up the fuel mixture and the cam ignition timing, everything appropriately for whatever that mixture is, because it can be variable. I mean, you might use fuel with ethanol one time and not the next, so the fuel system has to be able to interpret and adjust for that. And so I've seen some recalls on various vehicles that had problems with that sensing system and either had to have a reflash of the computer that reads it or a replacement of a sensor so that it could handle it properly. That obviously tells us that there's potential for any given vehicle to have one of those sensors malfunction. Even if there isn't a recall on that vehicle, there might be something on your vehicle that is not reading that right, because that it should not cause that problem. Just straight up 10% ethanol. I don't have concerns of burning ethanol in you know the proper ethanol, either the E85 for flex or 10% for a vehicle like yours, in vehicles at all. I mean, you know, if there's something malfunctioning in the car, that's one thing, but I don't see problems using it at all there. So there's something going on with that Traverse that it's not reading that right, and it's not getting the alcohol density adjustment right for the fuel system.
To make a long story short here, when she's on the road by herself, when she goes to visit her sister occasionally, her sister's having some medical problems in Texas, would I be better off just sticking away from the non-ethanol gas?
Well, that sounds like a simple fix. I mean, obviously, the preference is to be able to get the problem fixed, because it's not always easy to find ethanol, non-ethanol gas, and that, you know, you don't want to end up in a situation where you can't find it, you're forced to use it, and you've got a car that's stalling. So the greatest preference is to get to the bottom of it, get it fixed so that you don't have to sweat it when it's time to fill it up.
Yeah, makes good sense to me, for sure. Thanks very much for calling. And Louie in Wausau, your turn. Hi, Louie.
Hello. My question is, when we go south in the winter, we leave one car behind, and it's a fairly new car with a computer and navigation and all that. So something is always on, it seems. Mm-hmm. And then we come back in 3 months, the battery's dead. So I've been handling that with jump start cables, which is always kind of exciting. And a little adventurous. And I wonder if there's a better way of dealing with that.
There is. There's a device called a battery tender. It's common in the marine industry when boats are often stored over the wintertime. They've got their battery systems. And it's essentially a smart charger. A traditional battery charger will just keep charging the battery until it just boils all of the fluid right out of it and just toast the thing, which obviously is not what you want. A smart charger or battery tender has the ability to sense the state of charge of the battery and not be charging it unless the charge gets down. And so those are definitely answered in that situation. Most of the time, that is not going to be on, but when it senses the battery charge getting down to a certain point, it's going to charge it just enough, shut back off, and help maintain it. It is the answer for that situation.
Okay, battery tender.
Right.
Yeah. All right. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Jim Ward, Service Manager at Smart Motors of Madison. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Jim Ward, Service Manager at Smart Motors of Madison. Talking vehicle maintenance with him today. Lots of callers online, lots of Facebook questions. Suzanne on Facebook asked if you could talk, Jim, about how car batteries are affected by the charging of mobile devices, and if there are any new car batteries on the horizon that will be better but probably more expensive.
Well, battery technology is one of the things that has just taken off by leaps and bounds over the last 10 years with hybrid technology. And the big batteries and hybrids are very different, but the conventional batteries in cars have changed and last longer than they ever used to. But that being said, we definitely have some incompatible technologies. Perhaps sometimes there are a lot of vehicles that won't charge, like some of the more powerful iPhones, like an i7. You may be able to use a USB port to play music over it, but a lot of times the phone's demand for amperage is too high for a given vehicle's USB output. So it's not necessarily just the battery in the car that's going to determine how well it can handle those devices. It's how the manufacturers have wired up those USB and those charge ports and how much amperage they're designed to handle. They're, you know, sometimes they'll blow a fuse. Other ones have warnings that'll just sort of flash a warning on the dash and tell you that it's exceeded, you know, the voltage, and it basically has got a smart override that shuts it down before it has a chance to blow a fuse or overheat something. But there's a whole suite of technologies there between the technology of the battery, which are improving greatly, and how the car is not just wired, but how the circuits are controlled and the computer programming that's used to allow it to charge those kind of devices. So we're at a point right now where, again, the technology, I think, for the devices is running at a higher speed, you know, is advancing quicker than the technology in the cars to charge them and keep up with them. And we do have some incompatibilities, and it is enough to, you know, people take all of the things you have to think about when you buy a car and all of the different factors that are involved. One of the last things people often think about is if their devices are compatible with everything in the car the way they would like them to be. And it can be one of the greatest frustrations after they bought the car to realize, I got to get a different phone if I want this to work. Or, you know, so there's a whole set of issues surrounding that. It isn't really just the batteries, but as time goes by, most certainly it will, you know, cars will be more adaptive to what's available in the way of those devices today. And by that time, there'll be devices out there that are a little beyond the car's technology. So this is going to be a constant, you know, rabbit and hare race that goes on for the next 10, 20 years for sure.
Ben emailed to say that he always connects the negative clamps to the negative terminals on both batteries when he's jump starting. Is there something wrong with this?
He's saying he does that. Well, they don't recommend that you put the negative clamp over the battery that's going to be the donor battery, because if we talk at length about jump starting, there's a number of things that you know, in terms of safety, that you want to make sure that battery isn't damaged, isn't swollen, hasn't frozen, doesn't have the, you know, but the real concern is this, is that when you connect the last cable to that dead battery, it can create a spark. And that battery potentially, because of the way it's discharged, could potentially have a lot of outgassing going on, which is an acid that is combustible and can blow up. Now, that doesn't usually happen. And when it does happen, it's often not as, I've seen batteries blow up, and I mean, it can be horrible. You could be injured terribly, or it could just go poof and there's a puff of smoke and the battery's just shot and it doesn't really cause any damage to anything else in the car, or it can cause a surge and it can cause other damage in the car. But what we are talking about is the potential for problems, and the best way to avoid that potential is not to connect that negative terminal to the vehicle that's getting jump started, but to attach it to some bare metal that will supply a good ground.
Let's go to David in South Milwaukee. Hi, David. Thank you for calling.
Jim, you're doing a heck of a service to us all. Thanks for being there.
Thanks, David.
I've got an oldie but goodie, a 97 Olds 88, and it's got an odd quirk to it. But before I go into that, if you could just repeat that transmission fluid change, because WHAD got knocked off the air during the whole answer for that.
What we talked about there was going by how the fluid looks and smells on the dipstick and how the car is used. If the car is used to tow, the fluid should be changed more, you know, probably about once a year, every 15,000 miles if you tow very much. If the vehicle has had experiences where you get like stuck in the snow and you have to go to reverse drive back and forth, that's hard on transmission fluid. But taking the dipstick out and smelling the fluid, if it's got kind of a burnt clay smell, it is probably a good idea to change it. If it's extremely dark and has kind of a tarry residue that stays on the dipstick when you wipe the fluid off, probably a good idea to change it. But if you're not having any problems, you don't tow, you haven't had those kind of experiences, and the fluid looks reasonably reddish and not tarry yet, then generally we're going to say it doesn't need to be changed.
Super, thanks for that. The quirk with my car is that I can't use the cigarette lighter for accessories. It won't work just with the car off, and it won't work with the car switch to accessory. It'll only work if I go to the point where I just about start the car. In other words, I have to turn the key as if I'm going to start it, but don't go all the way to where it starts. And in the old days, they would say, hey, you're going to burn your points out if you leave it like that. So I'm wondering if that's a quirk or if that's the nature of the car, and that's okay to do that.
Well, that's how that car is wired, but they, you know, and of course we don't have points to worry about in that car, but there are other electronic ignition components that can be affected by leaving that ignition in a position where those lights are all on. Different manufacturers have their own ideas about what should be hot or on when it's in the accessory position, or what should only be on when it's turned all the way on. And some cars you can run your radio, some cars the lighter, or the lighter or the power port will work. I'm pretty sure in your Oldsmobile that is how that car is wired. They really only want you using the amount of power that is a fairly high output. You know, the lighter itself is a fairly high output device. So generally, the engineers who designed that car really only wanted that used when the car was running, when you were using alternator power, not using battery power, and drawing it that way.
So am I causing harm to the car by leaving it on for, you know, several minutes while I use an accessory?
Well, potentially, you know, you potentially are. It in most cases, that's not going to cause a problem. And you can have that lighter circuit rewired so that it's before the battery. You know, somebody could take it, disconnect the pin that it's in, and put it in a different pin at the junction block or fuse block so that it's before the ignition switch and just runs right off of battery power. And that's the preferred way to do it. Yep.
Yeah. That would be fairly simple to do.
Yep, not a terribly difficult thing. There's probably a YouTube video telling you how to do it, but as with anything, be very careful. If you're working with electrical circuits, disconnect that battery first.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks a lot for calling, David. Sue and DePere, thank you for calling. Hi, Sue.
Hi, Larry and Jim. And Jim, you need to be on more often. You got a question. The last time you were on, you talked about synthetic oil and mileage. But what about synthetic oil and life? I mean, if you have it in a vehicle that sits a while, how long would it be until it broke down?
Well, breaking down, synthetic oils don't break down nearly as quickly as conventional oils did, but both of them are subject to getting water condensation in them. And, you know, generally, the engineers that design the cars, not just the engines and not just the oil and lubrication systems, but the whole car, really kind of intend for that car to be looked over by somebody that is you know, mechanically certified about twice a year, about every 6 months. You might only have an oil change once a year or every 10,000 miles, but other systems should be checked. Tires are rotated at that other interval. But just specifically in terms of the oil, you know, if somebody drives 2,000 miles a year and has a car that has synthetic oil, you know, could they go 5 years without changing that oil and not have a problem? Probably. But, you know, that over that time, that 2,000 miles is probably either put on very short trips or the car not being used every day. And again, we have that concern of condensation getting in the engine and getting in that oil system. And, you know, ultimately, it's even though synthetic oil is quite a bit more expensive than regular oil changes. It's not quite twice as much, but it's more expensive. I think it's one of the cheaper insurances, just not to have to worry about to worry about the problem. And, you know, one of the concerns I have about those long intervals as these cars get older is that they will start to use oil, and people aren't in the habit of checking oil. And, you know, so if you get your oil changed at the interval it should, if that car has been using oil once it's up over 100,000, 200,000 miles, if you're not in the habit of checking it, you know, getting it in there on time and having someone find that it was a couple quarts low might save you having to do a expensive engine repair. So it isn't that expensive a maintenance item to do. I would recommend sticking with manufacturer recommendations, which are going to be time or miles, whichever come first. And for synthetic oils, it's often going to be a year or 10,000 miles, but I'd check your vehicle's manufacturer, and that really is just the safest, cheapest insurance.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Rick from Eau Claire said his daughter's 2001 Buick Regal GS had the same issue as the previous caller's Suburban, where the engine would cut out randomly. He was able to deduce that it only happened when the compressor is being used. Turned out an electrical surge took place when the compressor would kick on and thus shut the motor off. Once he replaced it, the issue disappeared.
Brilliant. Yep.
Brilliant.
Yep. It certainly could be the case in the Suburban, but there, you know, ultimately it's a trial and error process. But, you know, it's something that if you're having that kind of intermittent problem, you need to play detective a little bit and try turning different things on and off like that, because again, until you can start to isolate it, it's wide open. It could be lots of different things. But yep, certainly an air conditioner compressor takes a lot of power, and if it's either mechanically trying to seize up or electronically having issues, that can take more load on the engine than it can handle. Yep.
Robert in Madison, thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi, Jim.
Hi.
Quick question. I got an 04 Sequoia, and my check engine, ABS light, and several other warning lights will come on, and I put the code meter on it. I think it's 128 it comes up, which is the one that it says it's not up to operating temperature, but the gauge shows that it's up to operating temperature. But as soon as I erase the code, it'll go for like another 100 miles without the code, without the lights coming on.
Your temperature gauge and the it uses one sensor, and your engine's computer that sets the fuel mixtures and the sensors have to compare their readings to is a different sensor. So what your temp gauge is telling you may not be the same information that the engine computer is getting. So that other sensor should be tested. It may be the sensor, it may be something in that circuit, it may be the connector on that sensor, but yeah, that's that you're looking at two different things there.
Yeah, there you go.
What's the thermostat? Would it be a thermostat problem or no?
Well, if the thermostat is not working right, then the engine's running cold, and the sensor that's dropping your gauges is going to reflect that too and show a cold engine. But the engine may be warm, and the computer may be getting a signal that the engine is not warm, that the other sensor, not that there's a different one than the one that controls your gauge, may be telling the engine, the computer, that the engine's actually warm when it's cold or vice versa. And again, that can be the sensor or it can be a connector, but it's important to remember there's one sensor that your gauge is reading from, but a different sensor that the engine's computer is reading from, and that one or that circuit is the one that's involved here.
Okay, so I checked the engine sensor, is that it?
Mm-hmm. The engine temp sensor.
Great. All right, thanks.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Andy has a 2003 Chevy Silverado 1500, which requires a few extra cranks of the engine, or to turn the engine over when it's cold. Once the engine turns in, it runs perfect. It has about 100,000 miles.
Well, not sure that there's anything wrong there, Andy. Many manufacturers have gone to what's called auto crank, whether you have a push button or whether you, like a push button car, obviously you're not holding that button in the way you hold a key on a traditional car that starts. And many cars that have a key you hold, it's not unusual sometimes to have to hold it 10, 15 seconds. So there may not be a malfunction there.
And we'll be back with our guest after the news. Stay with us. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking vehicle maintenance today with Jim Ward. Doesn't he do a great job? He's a service manager at Smart Motors of Madison. Great to have him along, and thank you for joining us. We're going to go right back to the phones. Carol in Kenosha, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
No problem, Larry. You are worth it. I have a 2015 Honda Fit, 16,000 miles on it. I bought it new. And a couple months ago, I started smelling fumes of gas in the car at random times. It would come, and then maybe a few weeks, nothing, and then come back. Being an older woman without a man with me, I knew if I went in there and just explained this, they wouldn't pay any attention to me. When the fumes were very strong, I was near enough to just drive it right into Honda. I did that. People could smell it. They took it apart, found nothing. They put dye in the tank, told me to drive it, which I did, took it back, nothing. Now they're acting like, well, just go away. We told you there's nothing we can do. But I've had a mechanic and two other knowledgeable men tell me they need to take the tank down, lower the tank, and they don't want to do that because it's under warranty, and it's a big job.
Hmm.
Is this where I'm at?
Well, what do you think?
I suspect that, I mean, you can get fuel odors from different sources on the car. There's the fuel delivery system that delivers the fuel up to the engine, and I doubt that's where this odor is coming from. There's what's called the evaporative emission system, and fuel has vapors, particularly this time of year we start seeing less of this, but the colder it gets, the less fuel produces vapor, but that vapor will produce pressure in the tank and it has to go somewhere. So the gas tanks have a system on them to, they have what's called a storage tank that basically takes those fuel evaporative vapors and it stores them, and they're actually part of what, they're a very marginal part of what your engine runs on, but they actually go back up to the intake, and with the fuel delivery system, they're part of what your engine burns when it runs. And I suspect that something in that system isn't working right now I think you said it was a 2015 fit that's got self-diagnostic systems for most of that evaporative system, but it isn't necessarily the kind of thing that the self-diagnostic systems can always catch, depending on what may have happened. You know, on a car that new, when we see a leak like that, and there's no way, it probably is going to involve dropping the tank to inspect some of the hoses and some of the, not the hoses that handle liquid fuel, but the ones that handle the vapor, because they can produce a very strong gas odor if that vapor is just getting out into the atmosphere. And often what we find has caused the problem is rodent mouse damage. Remember, they'll get up on top of that tank because it's kind of a warm spot and kind of nest up there and chew into some of that hoses. Now, I can't know that that's what's going on with your car, but if they've ever seen that at Honda, then they realize that going into it, they may think it's warranty going into it, and find out if it's mouse chewed wires, the warranty's not going to cover it. And again, I can't know that it's mouse damaged wires, that it's even the evaporative system, but if they smell the fuel, they know something's going on. And, ultimately, I guess if that shop, it seems to be non-responsive. It shouldn't matter whether you're a man or a woman or anybody. You got a gas odor. Everybody should be concerned about it, trying to get into the bottom of it. So I guess you might make one more appeal, talk to the service manager at that shop. I'm sure he would like for his people to get to the bottom of it. And if you don't get satisfaction, I'd probably try another shop and see if they can check it out. If my theory is correct, as we go into this colder weather, you're going to smell less and less of that because the fuel just doesn't produce the vapors when we get down below, about freezing temperatures. Obviously, we've had a pretty warm, long fall here, and still potential for those vapors right now. But that's where I suspect this problem is. And they are probably going to have to drop the tank. And, ultimately, if they've had experiences where most of the time it's been rodent damage, they may ask you to authorize dropping that tank down. They may very well hope that, when they get in there, they find a warranty condition. But the chances are those devices and those hoses don't deteriorate so quickly that on that new car, they should be aged and deteriorated unless something has happened to them or something's chewed into them.
Hmm. Well, most of it happened in the warmer weather.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, it's typically going to be in the warmer weather, right, because you have more.
I've met several times with the manager. So now with this knowledge, I will ask him about that. Is this the idea that with cooler weather, this will probably diminish.
But that doesn't mean it's fixed either.
It'll come back.
Right. And the thing is, if it is rodent damage, most often your insurance company that you insure your car with will cover those kind of repairs and the diagnosis ultimately. You may have to authorize diagnosing it, but if that's what it turns out to be, I'd get the insurance company involved because they probably will cover that.
Hmm. Yeah, that makes good. So good luck, Carol. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate your call. Deborah in Winona, Minnesota, it's your turn. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a 2010 Toyota Corolla with about 75,000 miles on it. And the last two or three oil changes I've had, I have it serviced at the dealer. They have suggested that I have a fuel induction service performed to clean the fuel system. Is that something I've asked people and they said, I've never had that done. So is that something I should be having done, or are they just trying to get some extra money?
It's not a Toyota manufacturer's recommendation, and there are a lot of dealers out there that will recommend it. It's not, there probably are some varnishes that are built up in the throttle of that vehicle and in the injectors of that vehicle, and we do occasionally have to replace injectors. So it's not necessarily completely unnecessary maintenance. The thing that has worked well for my own vehicle maintenance over the years and in this business for my customers is I tend to stick with the manufacturer's base recommendations, and that's not one of them unless you're having a problem. If you're not having a drivability problem, I don't think it's a bad shop that's trying to soak somebody for something that's completely unnecessary, because I have these discussions with a couple of my mechanics regularly that say, varnish does build up. Once upon a time, when we had mechanical linkage basically had a cable between your gas pedal and the throttle. If those varnishes built up, you could feel it. You would actually feel the gas pedal sticking. Well, now that's all electronic. You're just making a request to a sensor, and they've made the systems more adaptive to where you won't feel that sticking, and the fuel system can actually adapt even if that throttle plate is sitting on a couple of centimeters of varnish, a little higher than it used to be. The fuel system will adapt to it, and the car seems to run fine, and you don't need to do anything. And with injectors, eventually you might have an injector stick and cause a misfire and have to replace it. But, you know, for the expense of an injector, if you're going to do that fuel induction service a couple times, you know, every couple of years, over 10 years, you're probably spending what you'd spend on an injector. You know, hopefully you would avoid having the breakdown you might have with an injector, but again, I just, my own philosophy is that if you're not having problems, I tend not to recommend those kind of things. And again, that I don't mean to cast any aspersions against a shop that does, because it can be good preventative maintenance. It's just not one that the manufacturer recommends. And it's just one of those things that it's easy as a shop owner to be on the fence on. You know, am I recommending enough maintenance, you know, as opposed to not enough? You know, a given individual's experience can vary. If you have an injector fail in the next 6 months, they're going to say, I told you so, you know, but you probably aren't going to have an injector fail, but you could. And so, I mean, it can prevent some conditions, but it isn't a regular regular maintenance item like oil changes. You know, I tend to look at those things only if we really have running problems.
All right.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks, Deborah. Adele in Michigan, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. And Jim, good to talk to you. I have a question about maintenance. I have a Dodge, and I went to the Dodge garage, and they took me out and showed me on the hoist where I needed an oil pan seal, so I could see that it was leaking. And then they said I probably needed an upper transmission seal also. So I went and sat down in the office with them and said, what are the costs? And $180 for the oil pan seal and $180 for the upper transmission, plus $107 for labor. And then the diagnosis on top of that. So I said, well, am I able to drive back to Wisconsin? I'm going there this week. And, oh, yeah, sure. So I came to my mechanic in Wisconsin, who has been very good to me, and he fixed it. I did not need the upper transmission because he said it was probably just the oil blowing back from, and he said the transmission is a different color.
Mm-hmm.
And he charged me $5 for the oil pan seal. And changed the oil, $20 labor, $150. My bill was $152. And my question is, how can the garages?
Oh, we lost you.
Well, it seems like we lost you, but I think we get the gist of what you're asking there. You know, and it sounds like the first garage, they call the transmission fluid leak, and they may have called it prematurely. And ultimately, you know, I'd like to think that if you had said to go ahead and do this, that if they'd gotten into a little further, discovered that, oh, this isn't where we thought it was from, that they wouldn't do the transmission seal. Of course, as consumers, we all are skeptical and think they would have done it anyway, you know, but there's really not a way to know that. They may not have. Typically, when I'm kind of a stickler about this, and not every shop does it this way, but when we have a fluid leak, fluids can blow back. They can follow creases on an engine block or transmission housing, and they can end up looking like they're coming from somewhere they're really not. And so what I tend to want to do with any fluid on a vehicle is they make dyes for any of the fluids, clean it off, get whatever we're seeing on the outside off, put the dye in it, have you drive it for 100, 200 miles. I mean, sometimes we can just take it on a test drive if it's a bad enough leak, but often they're slow seeping kind of leaks where we need to have you drive it a couple hundred miles, bring it back in. Those dyes tend to fluoresce under a black light, and we wear these special glasses in the black light, and we look for where the source really is at so that we don't end up either, you know, having recommended something that we don't end up later doing, or doing something that didn't need to be done that was actually a different source. And, you know, part of the question seemed to be about price discrepancy as well. It sounds like your local mechanic did that oil pan for a really reasonable, really good price. Again, a guy that runs his own shop, or maybe isn't even running a shop, but just is a mechanic and does work on the side.
Yes, no.
Oh,
he
you
has
are still
a legitimate shop in Milwaukee.
Okay.
He's my mechanic because this has happened before.
Okay. Well, we thought we'd lost you there for a moment, so we were kind of making up part of the rest of the story. So, yeah, I mean, you know, there are lots of possible reasons for that. There are dishonest shops. They're going to give somebody that's just passing through a higher price, but we all get our labor times from a published time guide generally, and the published time guides do vary. I've seen variances as much as for the same vehicle, for the same job, one guide might say 5.8 hours, or another guide says 13.2 hours. One guide may be presuming that you have to pull the engine to do this job, or another guide realizes that, no, you can prop that engine up or support it in a way, and you can find a shortcut or a different way to do the job. So, you know, there are legitimate reasons sometimes that the pricing guide that they're using may be different. And you know, again, it's not like that this our business isn't different than any others. It may be that a shop wasn't giving you an honest quote. But, you know, it's always a good idea to check out pricing. You know, most of what we do on cars anymore is maintenance, and those are the things you do day in and day out, and you know the pricing off the top of your head. But when it comes to repairs and things that weren't expected, you know, it's a good idea to at least go online and look at, like, RepairPal.com and see what that given job is going for in a given area. And, again, it may not be that the shop is being dishonest. It just may be that they don't do that work that much and don't have the guy that's got the most accurate time for it. But it certainly, as a consumer, you want to protect yourself and take a look and do some comparisons, get a second opinion and a second price. And it sounds like in this case, you definitely made a good decision, saved yourself a lot of money in doing that.
Yeah, and where was that site again that you mentioned?
RepairPal.com. There's a lot of different ones, but in a mm-hmm. given, you can put in your zip code and you can put in a given year and model vehicle in a repair, and it'll tell you what the range for that repair generally is in a given area.
Interesting.
But to me, that's like 1,000 over what an oil pan. And I had talked to another friend. He said, oh, an oil pan is like $10.
Well, we might be talking about the oil pan gasket. The oil pans tend to be more expensive than that, but you know, it sounds like maybe
oil
they just
pan
had to
gasket
reseal
might
it.
Be $10.
And a lot of times, oil pan gasket is really not even a gasket. It's what's called form in place gasket, which is kind of like a caulk. So
yeah,
and I think that is what that vehicle uses. But yeah, but that would be that a tube of that would be $7 to $10. Which in that case, you wouldn't be replacing the pan. You'd be taking it off, cleaning off the old form in place gasket, putting on the new, and putting it back on.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks a lot, Adele. Appreciate your call. Clarence in Watertown, it's your turn. Hi, Clarence.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Have a 2003 Honda Element, I believe 2.4 liter, 180,000 miles on it. And, of course, the last year we stuck a lot of money into it, starter, drive shaft, all these, you know, brand-new tires. We're driving along, and it started limping and missing. Tech said one cylinder is down to only about 20 pounds of compression. He says, just, you know, get rid of it, wholesale it out. I was wondering if your guest had any ideas on this thing.
Well, they could do further diagnostic tests to determine why there's a loss of compression there. I mean, there's a number of possibilities. We could have a valve train breakdown that's allowing the compression out an intake or an exhaust valve. We could have piston sealing rings that are gotten varnished up and aren't sealing right, and could have blow by that's blowing that compression into the oil. And there's some tests that they can run to determine it. I mean, the very best case scenario is that you've got a varnished up cylinder that's got stuck piston rings, and in the very best world, you'd put some, you know, you'd change the oil and leave it a quart short and put that quart automatic transmission fluid, a high detergent automatic transmission fluid, in there, run it for about 15 minutes, drain that all out, maybe do that a couple times, and it might clear that varnish up and resolve it. That's not going to be true most of the time, but that's the best case, best world scenario, is that would be the cause of the problem, and that would be the resolution of the problem, and you didn't have to be invasive and tear the engine down. But in these situations, you know, the age of the vehicle, the potential expense, it's all the more likely that really that engine's probably going to have to be torn down and rebuilt, or potentially replaced with a used engine or something. So it does have the potential to be quite expensive. In most cases, it's unfortunately not going to be the simple fix is running some high detergent transmission fluid in there to break down the varnishes and get those piston rings to seal again. You know, but that is a best case scenario. So, you know, if you have them go a little further and they determine it is blow by that's going by the rings, it may be something that you want to try it. It doesn't cost much to try that, and again, I don't think there's a great chance it's going to fix your problem, but I have seen it fix that problem before, so
there you go. Thanks for calling, Clarence. Alex in Neillsville, hello to you.
Yeah, hi. I apologize if the audio is a little poor. I'm actually on the road right now to go look at potentially purchasing a used truck, and I've got a schedule for a safety inspection at a nearby garage. But an earlier caller was talking about synthetic oils, and it got me thinking, are there things like how quickly, again, it's an older
2002, how quickly it burns through oil that just aren't going to be detectable by a safety inspection or by looking at it.
Unfortunately, that is absolutely true. An oil burner, you know, most 2002 is a late enough vehicle that the catalytic converter in it, if that's burning a quart oil in 1,000 miles or in 600 miles, you'd think it'd be smoking, but most often they don't smoke because the device in the exhaust is supposed to clean up the unburned hydrocarbons from the fuel is usually just as happy burning up a little bit of oil like that. At some point, the oil can become too much, the converter can gum up and not work properly and turn a warning light on, but long, long before that happens, it can just happily prevent that engine from causing smoke out the tailpipe. So there certainly are things like that that, you know, ultimately, if you know, depending on how, you know, they look the vehicle over, they're going to see most things. But that is one area that oil consumption, and I mean, dealers, you know, that take cars in on trade are just as prone to vulnerable to that. You take it in and there's certain things you just can't see, and you may never know until the next person buys it and starts driving it. And that is certainly one of them. That, you know, theoretically you could look at the plugs and see if they're more foul, but honestly, you know, a 2002 in any engine within about, you know, a handful of years older than that, you know, probably about 12 years older than that, newer than that, may not show a sign on the plugs because of how the ignitions work and how everything else works, that you can have that kind of a hidden issue.
Yeah, there you go. All right, thanks, Alex, for calling. Tim and Marinette, what's on your mind?
Yes, I was wondering what your guests thought about fuel additives that you add to the tank for cleaning the injectors and stuff like that, and if they enhance like mileage or anything, or what are his thoughts on that?
Well, just as a general, why not? You know, if there's nothing wrong with the car, I'm not a fan of it. The more you listen to me, you'll realize that if it's not broke, don't fix it. Is kind of the philosophy I tend to have. It in my own experiences, you know, that with fuel additives you put in the tank, if you do have a fuel system problem, you know, we had a caller earlier that was talking about a dealer recommending a fuel induction service. You know, in most cases, I would recommend, if you have a fuel system problem, you're going to try something that if the car is not running too bad, if you just have a slight misfire or something, or that trying a quality fuel additive in the tank is certainly the least invasive thing to do, and they can work. But generally, I don't believe in them for just increasing fuel mileage and power, and just, you know, if you're not having a problem, it's just not something I would recommend playing with. If you are having a problem and you're going to use something, you do want to look into a better quality. You know, once as a very young guy, I had what I thought was a fuel system gumming up. I bought a product I'm not going to name, but it was way too strong a solvent. Put it in the gas tank, it loosened stuff up and created a much bigger problem than I ever would have had if I'd never done that. And, you know, that's learning the hard way. So, you know, those products have their place, but not if you're not having a problem, and they're not all the same. So do a little bit of research about what you're thinking about using, and make sure that it's the appropriate product and not just a real strong solvent.
And Parker and Ryo, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I've got a 99 GMC 1500. It's got the 4L60E transmission in it. I was driving it on the interstate with a trailer behind it, pulled off to a gas station, pulled back on, and it no longer had third or fourth gear. I was wondering if that was more likely the solenoids or if that was the clutch pack going out.
Well, usually when the clutch packs go out, you lose all your forward gears. I mean, it's possible to just lose a couple of them, but I would be suspicious of solenoids, and ultimately, you know, taking an oil sample out of that transmission, if clutch packs are failing, it's going to have a lot of that fiber material in the oil. You know, I doubt that there's going to be metal in there because that doesn't sound like the kind of problem, but if there were metal in there, that generally looking at that fluid and seeing what's in it or what's not in it can give you a good hint as to what's going on. You know, it certainly could be a solenoid problem, but essentially I guess that's the next step, is that there are some tests that they can run on the solenoids from outside the transmission to try to tell if they're functioning right or not. And again, the fluid sample, you know, probably dropping the pan and taking a look at the oil in it is going to be very telling as to what's going on in there.
Oh, well, the music tells me that we are out of time, Jim. Boy, it flew by.
Thank you so much.
I hope you're, well, I don't have a scheduled date for you, but we'll hopefully you'll come back and be with us again.
I'd be delighted. We'll probably see you again in 2018.
All right. Jim Ward, service manager at Smart Motors, of Madison. Great to have him back. And he does such a wonderful job. And we'll have him back and we'll do this all over again. Tomorrow, Jeff Epping visits with us from the Obrick Botanical Gardens. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us.